From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Indianapolis in 2015 when Indiana Governor Mike Pence signed a so-called Religious Freedom Bill into law. It quickly became a national issue. Governor Pence said the law was designed to offer legal protections to Indiana business owners who didn't want to participate in gay weddings because of their religious beliefs. Opponents argued that Pence was supporting discrimination. Even President Obama referred to the law at the 2015 White House Correspondents' Dinner, saying that he and Joe Biden were so close, quote, in some places in Indiana, they won't serve us pizza anymore, end quote. But Pence's supporters say he should be known for much more than his social conservatism. They say Pence has helped revive Indiana's economy. And now the Indiana governor is Donald Trump's running mate. Pence will have a headline role this week at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. This hour, a preview of the RNC of sorts, and we'll begin with a look at who the next possible vice president is. In studio with us is Wes Renfro, the chair of the Department of Political Science and Legal Studies at St. John Fisher College. Wes, welcome.
Thank you.
And also with us on the line, Brandon J. Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, who has covered Governor Pence there. Brandon, thank you for taking the time. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good. The pick of Mike Pence, I suppose, not a surprise to all of you who have covered him for a while.
It was a little bit of a surprise, if only because, as you mentioned right off the top, the controversy last year surrounding the religious freedom law really dampened what were at the time Governor Pence's presidential ambitions. There was a lot of rumors that he was going to make a bid for president, but that kind of negated any of those hopes. And so we thought maybe for a while that his national ambitions had been sort of hamstrung by that controversy, but they were certainly not when it came to vice president.
Okay, and the Washington Post has reported that, and this is not something I confess I've followed closely, don't live in Indiana, but the Washington Post has reported that Governor Pence was in a pretty tight reelection bid for governor himself. Is that right?
Absolutely. In a lot of the polling we'd seen, which admittedly is not very much, it's a notoriously difficult state to poll for a variety of reasons, but in the limited polling we've seen here in Indiana, he was in a virtual tie with his Democratic counterpart, John Gregg, who he actually ran against last time when he was running for governor in 2012.
Okay. Well, Brandon, when it came to that the Religious Freedom Bill, remind our listeners how things turned out with that.
So it all happened in the span of about a week, which was one of the craziest weeks of my life, I can assure you.
yeah.
They passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which, as you mentioned, was meant to give some particularly religious businesses or people with religious convictions cover when they wanted to, for instance, deny services to a gay couple and participate in their wedding. Well, there was immediate backlash once the governor signed the law, which was on a Thursday. The following Thursday, they passed a follow-up bill that really blunted any of that criticism. It specifically said that the law could not be construed to allow anyone to deny services to anyone on the basis of a variety of things, including their sexual orientation and gender identity. What happened in between that week was international, in some cases, national and international backlash from businesses, other governors. As you mentioned, the president joked about it. It was a popular joke on all the late night shows. And a lot of it was focused on Governor Pence, and really not even as much what the law actually said, but more about how he handled that controversy.
I recall an interview with George Stephanopoulos, for example, in which it did not go very well. I think even social conservatives might have felt like that he was not handling himself and responding to some of the criticism well. Did they feel that he sold out at all, or what do social conservatives think of the outcome of that?
They were not happy with it, and precisely because they did feel like he went back on what he had done. He had signed the bill. They were very happy about that. There was this sort of now infamous photo of the private bill signing in his office surrounded by various social conservative lobbyists and organizational leaders and, in some cases, clergy. And they were thrilled about the law in the first place. They felt like the so-called fix that was passed a week later really blunted the law's effects and made it worse, and they were not happy that the governor and the legislature had sort of gone back on that.
Okay, but Brandon, I don't think there's any doubt, at least from what I'm reading, that for social conservatives, if you're a social conservative, Governor Pence is someone who has been pretty authentically revered in those circles for a long time. I mean, just for example, this past spring, he signed into law a new abortion law in Indiana, right? I mean, this is he has been a social conservative for a long time.
Yeah, when you talk about Mike Pence, he is a staunch, staunch, staunch social conservative. His bona fides in that realm go back literally decades. There's no doubt that that is obviously the biggest thing he brings to Donald Trump's ticket.
Listeners, if you have any questions, we've got Brandon J. Smith joining us for the first portion of the program today. Any questions you have on Governor Pence, who is now the vice presidential candidate for the Republican Party this year, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Before the program began, I was talking to Wes just about the functionality of this pick, and Wes, Donald Trump himself said last night on 60 Minutes, and we've got a few clips there, we'll get to that in a minute. He said last night that he's not going to apologize for making a pick that is designed to unify the party more, but then he went on to say, look, I'm a Christian, I won evangelicals, which he did. He won evangelicals handily in the primaries, and he said, I didn't need Mike Pence, but maybe that will help. Does this pick, you know, sort of typically help him, and do we put too much emphasis on VP picks to begin with?
So there's not a lot of evidence that suggests that the VP pick really affects the outcome of the general election, maybe in a very tight race, maybe in a critical swing state. I understand the impulse to select Pence because it helps shore up Trump's credentials with a section of the base that really doesn't love him in the way that he thinks that he does. But it doesn't get him a lot in terms of the general election. And so I think it's somewhat of a mixed bag.
Okay. Well, a listener named Angie is already emailing to ask about all of the boasting about the economic record. And we have heard Donald Trump say that he has selected Mike Pence because he's been one of the best governors in the country, that he's helped revitalize the Indiana economy. Brandon, how do you answer Angie's question? What does the evidence say there?
There is some evidence. I mean, Indiana's economy has recovered, and in a lot of ways better than a lot of other parts of the nation. There is no doubt about that. There are other measures by which that it's harder to brag about Indiana. For instance, the per capita income has really lagged behind the rest of the nation. It's in the bottom third of the country, though people on the other side will often point to the fact that the cost of living is lower in Indiana, which is true. But the biggest thing here that you can quibble about with the pick of Mike Pence is a lot of people here, including a lot of Republicans in Indiana, don't point to Mike Pence as the reason that Indiana's economy has rebounded. They point to former Governor Mitch Daniels, his predecessor, who's now the president of Purdue and is often mentioned, quite frankly, in national circles as a potential vice president or presidential pick. There's a lot of people who feel like the kudos go to Mitch Daniels and everything he did prior to leaving office. And what Mike Pence has done is just sort of continuing along what Daniels did in the first place.
And not to get off too far off track here, but Mitch Daniels, I just have a question. Is it true? Everything I read was that he was very much interested in running for president, but his family and his wife in particular did not want him to. He could have been a presidential contender, right?
He could have been a presidential contender in 2012.
Yeah.
That was the year in particular. He theoretically could have been one this year, though I think on his part there was a lot less desire to do so this time. He's got a pretty nice job running Purdue University here in Indiana. But yes, it was primarily family concerns that led him not to pursue that. And quite frankly, that's not the first time we've seen that. He's in the past, going all the way back to when Dan Quayle had to leave the U.S. Senate to become vice president for George H.W. Bush, Mitch Daniels was offered that seat here in Indiana and turned it down because he wanted to stay back in Indiana with his wife and his children.
All right, let me ask both of our guests to respond to some of the clips that we have from 60 Minutes. Last night on 60 Minutes, Leslie Stahl sat down with both Donald Trump and Mike Pence together, though Wes Renfro, as you have found, the word counts indicate Donald Trump did most of the talking, even at the questions directed at Mike Pence, didn't he?
Yeah, I think it was an extremely awkward interview, and Pence clocked in at around 900 words, with Trump clocking in at about 2,200 words. I think that speaks volumes about their relationship. I also want to point out that oftentimes the vice presidential candidate serves an attack dog function. It's not clear to me that Trump needs him to fulfill that.
That is a great point. In fact, for that reason, let's start on the middle clip here, Rob. When Leslie Stahl brought up the fact that Mike Pence has said in the past that he doesn't really believe in negative campaigning, Leslie Stahl said, you know, What about Donald Trump and Lion Ted and Little Marco and all of those things? Trump basically said, look, I'm still going to call Hillary Clinton Crooked Hillary, but I wouldn't expect Mike to do that. It's not in his nature. It'd be out of character for him. Then Leslie Stahl asks about John McCain. Now, Leslie Stahl pointed out that Donald Trump has said John McCain wasn't a hero. He was more of a loser because he got captured at war. And that was the moment last year I thought, well, the whole campaign's going off the rails. Of course, I was wrong about that. But this is an interesting exchange, starting with Leslie Stahl asking Mike Pence about those comments about McCain.
Do you think John McCain is not a hero because he was captured?
I have a great deal of respect for John McCain.
Do you think he went too far?
You could say yes. That's okay. You could say yes. I mean, you know, it's fine. Hey, look, I like John McCain. But we have to take care of our vets.
No, but I want to know if Mr. Pence would go in and say to you, what did you say? You know, would you do something like that?
I promise you that when the circumstances arise where I have a difference on policy or on presentation, I can tell you in my heart, I know I would have no hesitation, were I privileged to be vice president, to walk into the president's office, close the door, and share my heart. And I also know this good man would listen and has the leadership qualities to draw from the people around him.
Brandon Smith, what did you make of that exchange?
That is classic Mike Pence. Starts off with not really answering the direct question asked. The way that Trump seemed to give him permission to say no was certainly fascinating, but this is a classic, and this is Mike Pence. This is what myself and my colleagues here at the State House have experienced the last 4 or 5 years in covering Mike Pence. He doesn't answer direct questions. He has a talking point or two in mind he's well prepared for interviews. He has a talking point or two in mind for just about every question that's probably going to be asked. He's going to deliver those talking points, and it really doesn't matter what else you say.
Yeah, interesting. And Brandon picked up on this. Wes, let me ask you about this. I've read some who even said that when Donald Trump jumped in and said, you can say no, saying to Mike Pence what he can and can't say, it was reminiscent of an abusive spousal relationship. You know, that it was uncomfortable, that it was, you know, sort of condescending. What did you make of that exchange?
I think they have very bad chemistry. It doesn't play well in the interview. I don't think it's going to play well on the campaign trail. And in all fairness to Pence, it's really difficult to imagine anybody having the sort of personality that could stand up to Donald Trump's bombast. I mean, he can nearly overshadow anyone.
Mm-hmm. So, in other words, not surprising, but he didn't necessarily pick a yes man, or at least Wes, he didn't pick somebody who's aligned with his views perfectly. In fact, Mike Pence endorsed Ted Cruz, and not the most forceful endorsement, but days before the Indiana primary endorsed Ted Cruz. Did it surprise you that he picked someone who didn't endorse him?
I think that, you know, he really wants to double down on the evangelical credentials. But again, there were reports that he wanted to walk back the Pence nomination after it was announced. And so there's some uncertainty with respect to how much Donald Trump actually believes in his own selection. I would also add that I think that it's the case that he didn't have a deep bench to choose from. I think a lot of folks who could have fulfilled the vice presidential role said, no, I'm going to sit this one out. This isn't a good year for Republicans in general, and I don't want to be associated with this campaign.
All right, I see the phone ringing. We'll get to your phone calls in a moment here. We're talking to Wes Renfro in studio. Wes is chair of the Department of Political Science and Legal Studies at St. John Fisher. And Brandon J. Smith on the line with us, a State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting who has covered Mike Pence and has gotten to know his record very well. And so a few more minutes with Brandon. Let's listen to another clip. This is Mike Pence talking about, well, let's choose the one on ISIS in Iraq. This is another one where Pence and Trump have differed. Now, Mike Pence, of course, was in Congress back in 2002, 2003, when the Iraq vote and the invasion were happening. And he was a strong supporter of the Iraq war?
At the time, yes.
Okay. Donald Trump has attacked Hillary Clinton, saying that her vote for the Iraq war, just as Mike Pence voted for it, Trump has said that is a sign of Clinton's weakness, poor judgment, and her inability to make the right decisions for the country. So Leslie Stahl took the chance to point that out. Let's listen to the full exchange on that.
We are going to get rid of ISIS, big league, and we're going to get rid of them fast. And we're going to use surrounding states, we're going to use NATO, probably. and we're going to declare war. It is war. When the World Trade Center comes tumbling down with thousands of people being killed, people are still, I have friends that are still
suffering. Well, we did go to war, if you remember. We went to Iraq.
Yeah, you went to Iraq, but that was handled so badly. And that was a war, by the way. That was a war that we shouldn't have, because Iraq did not knock down.
Your running mate
Iraq did not
voted for it.
I don't care.
What do you mean you don't care that he voted?
It's a long time ago. And he voted that way, and they were also misled. A lot of information was given to people, but I was against the war in Iraq from the beginning.
Yeah, but you've used that vote that of Hillary's, that was the same as Governor Pence,
many people
as the example of her bad judgment.
Many people have, and frankly, I'm one of the few that was right on Iraq.
Yeah, but what about he did?
He's entitled to make a mistake every once in a while.
But she's not. Okay, come on.
But she's not.
She's not.
No, she's not.
All right, so a number of things. It should be pointed out, and Leslie Stahl should have pointed it out. Donald Trump was not against the Iraq War. He is not telling an accurate story there. He was on the record in interviews at the time saying that he did support the invasion, but whatever. Donald Trump now says he was not for the Iraq War. Wes Renfro, that exchange, could the Clinton camp and could Democrats use that against Trump, saying, listen, if you don't care if your vice presidential choice voted for it and you say it was a long time ago and he was misled, how can you attack Hillary Clinton? Is that a possible concern?
I think it's possible, but you know, given that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are so well known, I'm actually skeptical that there's a lot of undecided voters left. And I think that for those undecided voters, this particular exchange or even similar exchanges, I'm not convinced that that's going to sway them one way or the other.
Interesting. Brandon, what did you make of that?
You know, it's tough to say what will matter to voters anymore at this point. As you just pointed out, Donald Trump doesn't seem to be telling the full truth on whether he supported the Iraq War, and certainly he doesn't now. But that's been pointed out before, and it doesn't seem to have made much of a dent in his popularity in the polls, at least in the primaries. It's tough to get a sense. I mean, we've also already seen Mike Pence go back on some of the positions he's already held once he became Trump's running mate.
Yeah, we're going to get to one of those in just a second. But before we do, let me get a phone call from a listener. This is John in Rochester with a question for Brandon Smith, who's on the line with us from Indianapolis. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Brandon. You know, I was really enthused when the state of Indiana passed right-to-work legislation a few years ago. In fact, it prompted Michigan to do the same, I think, to protect some of the companies from moving into Indiana. Did Mike Pence have a lot to do with their right-to-work legislation?
No, that was actually just before Governor Pence became governor. That was in 2012 that Indiana passed that law, and Mike was elected governor that fall. So that was primarily under former Governor Mitch Daniels, which goes back to kind of my point that I made a little earlier, which is a lot of the things that Mike Pence takes credit for, a lot of things that he's praised for, were really things that were either created by or started under Mitch Daniels and have just been continued when Pence took office.
Well, you could say the same thing, I guess, about Bill Clinton after Reagan and H.W. Bush.
Some people
Thanks
do
a lot.
Say that, absolutely.
Thank you, John. Do we know where Mike Pence stands on right to work and that kind of legislation, you know, sort of nationally speaking, Brandon?
My guess is I don't know if I've ever asked him directly about right to work, though that sort of legislation he's strongly in favor of. For instance, they passed something sort of similar that had to do with what's called the common construction wage, which is a sort of minimum wage for public construction projects. They passed something eliminating that in the last couple of years, and Pence was strongly in favor of that.
Okay. And on economics, Pence has not only supported free trade deals, he voted for NAFTA. He was in favor of NAFTA, and he has strongly supported the TPP, which Donald Trump has called rape on numerous occasions. Let's listen to Leslie Stahl asking Mike Pence about Donald Trump on trade and where they seem to be very deeply disagreeing.
You have voted for every trade agreement when you were in Congress that came before you. You're supporting the Trans-Pacific Partnership that Mr. Trump says would rape this country. Now, are you going to be able to go out and campaign in support of his protectionist positions?
Well, I support free trade, and so does Donald Trump.
I do. Oh, no, I'm free trade, but I want to make good deals. No, I'm all for free
trade. You talk about
I'm not an isolationist. A lot of people think because I want to make good deals,
you want to undo these
people.
Agreements.
Wait a minute, Leslie. These are stupid people that think that. I want to make great deals for our country. We have deals like the deal signed by Bill Clinton, NAFTA, one of the worst things that ever happened to this country in terms of trade, in terms of economics.
What do you think about NAFTA?
You're absolutely right. I've supported free trade throughout my career. But
okay.
The truth of the matter is NAFTA has provisions in that law that call for it to be reviewed that have never been initiated.
Okay, so Brandon, you mentioned that Mr. Pence has an ability to stick to his talking points, and there Leslie Stahl trying to press him, saying, Trump says NAFTA is the worst trade deal ever, you voted for it. Trump says TPP is rape, you supported it. And Mike Pence's response is, hey, we're both free traders. I mean, what did you make of that exchange?
It's exactly what I was talking about before. He didn't answer the question, but the answer he did provide was crafted in such a way that if you went back later and said, "Oh well, you flip-flopped. You said you're now against TPP." He never said that either. He said nothing that could be construed as a yes or no or A or B.
Yeah.
It was a way to give this very broad answer that is tangentially related to the question asked. That is Mike Pence all day.
And I don't want to be overly critical. I haven't seen the raw interview tape. I don't know exactly what Leslie Stahl asked, but I would have loved if she would have just said, okay, so can we now say you oppose the TPP just as Mr. Trump did? That would have been clarifying, wouldn't it?
If he had answered the question.
Okay.
I just want to jump in and point out something.
Yeah, go ahead, Wes.
About the factual discrepancies with support for the Iraq war or whether or not Mike Pence supports right to work. We actually know with a great deal of certainty that that doesn't actually matter. There are very few high information voters in the general election. Most people vote with what I like to call the feels. It doesn't matter if they know the record. It doesn't matter if there's inconsistencies. That doesn't actually seem to sway voter behavior. And so I think folks like us can sometimes make a big deal out of these issues. That doesn't really translate into the millions, tens of millions of folks that will vote in November.
Well, I would just make one other point, and then I'm going to ask for some final remarks from Brandon Smith before we let him go. I would just say to that, Wes, I know historically you're right about that, but I also don't want to get so bogged down in sort of the Mark Halperin horse race addiction where we say, well, policy doesn't matter. So, I mean, I do want to talk policy. I think it does. So I guess I would like it to matter more.
Me too.
I may be fighting a losing battle there. I take the point you're making, but I think it's important to at least discuss the policy to give people information whether they want it or not. So, Brandon, some final remarks from you as the State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. What else do you expect from Mike Pence in this campaign?
I think you'll see him do what he does best, which is go out into communities and try to connect with the average voter. He is very, very good at that. We see that here in the state. He is a different person when he's in the State House wearing that governor hat as opposed to when he's out of the building, out in the communities, and just talking with people. That's where he sort of thrives, and I think that's why he was a good pick.
And will be the anti-attack dog, but sort of a warmer, more connecting face, you think, in this campaign?
Absolutely. That's where he thrives.
Thank you, Brandon. We appreciate it. And for those who want to read more of your work, this is a great time for you to let our listeners know, because I have certainly appreciated it. Where can they find more of your work?
Well, I work for a variety of stations, so any of those. But if you go to my Twitter page, which is at BrandonJSmith5, you can certainly find links to all of my stations and all of my work.
Thank you for taking the time for this program, Brandon.
Thank you for having me.
The State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Wes, on the subject of the attack dog, you know, how interesting. This is the first time I think that I can recall a campaign, and I'm sure you'll remember one, or maybe some that I'm not recalling. But usually it is, yeah, a VP choice who can be the one to deliver more of the knife verbally. And Donald Trump doesn't need it. Mike Pence is known as sort of a nice guy. He's congenial. He gets along well with people. So I guess in this case, Donald Trump didn't have to find someone. Maybe that hurt Chris Christie. You know, maybe I'm reading too much into that. What do you think?
It's something of a loss as to why Mike Pence was selected. You know, if you look at his record, if you look at how he plays in the media, if you look at his message vis-a-vis family values, he's not someone who's going to deliver or feel comfortable delivering that sort of negative message, nor does Trump need him. And so I keep going back to this notion of why didn't Trump pick somebody who perhaps could have moved a swing state into his column?
Could this be to galvanize evangelicals? Because I know Trump won evangelicals in the primaries, but I also know, and I've talked to many Christian voters who don't view him as authentic, understandably so. Is this to maybe galvanize that vote and say, at least get us out there?
So Donald Trump is caught in two crosshairs. One is that his support among traditional evangelical Republicans is, as you've noted, pretty low. He needs to get those folks to show up in November. But even if he's able to produce robust turnout with that population, he still needs to bring in folks who lean a little bit more towards the center. And this guy is not going to help him with the latter.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour. We'll come back and we're going to bring Karen DeWitt into the conversation. Our Capitol Bureau correspondent is covering the convention from Cleveland, which gets underway today. And Karen's going to join us to kind of set the scene a little bit. So we'll talk to Karen coming back. Also, you're going to hear from Wes a very interesting point about what you may not see this week at the Republican National Convention that you have historically seen at conventions in the past. That's coming up in just a moment. Coming up in our second hour, Monroe County Executive Cheryl Donolfo and Monroe County Clerk Adam Bello join us in studio. They're discussing pistol permit applications. Those forms, thousands of them, have been sitting in a file cabinet in the clerk's office. And the current clerk, Adam Bello, says it's become a mess. But Donolfo says there's been a misunderstanding and she's going to explain. We'll talk about all of that next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The Republican National Convention kicking off in Cleveland today. Wes Renfro is in studio with me. He's the chair of the Department of Political Science and Legal Studies at St. John Fisher College. And on the line with us from Cleveland is Karen DeWitt, who is covering the convention, covering the New York delegation. Karen, how are you?
Well, I am stopping to catch my breath after a very busy morning covering the New York delegation breakfast. We heard from Newt Gingrich, who gave a very interesting speech, got reaction to it. We talked to Ed Cox for a while, and I mean, you guys probably know how conventions are. There's just a lot going on all the time, so I've been spinning like a top, but it's been very interesting.
Here, it finally looks like we're sitting in a studio on State Street, and it looks like we're on the inside of a car wash. Finally, it's Armageddon-like rain, which we have been desperate for. How is everything in Cleveland?
Hey, you know, I live in Albany, so usually I get the weather after you, but today I got it before you. I heard those thunderstorms. It was still dark here very early this morning, and they were very, very noisy, and I assume that's what you're experiencing now.
But Cleveland looks pretty good now?
It's clearing up, so
yeah,
you've got clear weather coming soon.
Home city. I'm glad it's going to be looking good for this week here. Mm-hmm. Karen is covering, you said, the New York delegation, and tonight, Karen, I think it's a law and order theme, if I have that correct. Is that right?
That's right. There's a theme every night, and tonight is law and order. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani is going to be speaking to that effect. And other speakers, Melania Trump, Trump's wife, I guess she'll be speaking about law and order. I'm not sure how that fits in, actually, but this is her night to speak. We heard from Newt Gingrich this morning, but he really didn't talk about law and order as much as he offered a game plan to New York's delegates for how they could win New York State and take it away from Hillary Clinton. And he said the key is New York City. He believes there are people in New York City who aren't happy and could be convinced to vote for Trump. So he talked about that a lot, and then he talked about foreign policy, offered a real takedown of Hillary Clinton, President Obama, John Kerry, saying they're sheep and they're letting the terrorists win. At some point, he kind of compared them to placating Hitler and Nazi Germany. So he wasn't really talking completely about law and order. So I guess not everything is on message completely today. But it was an interesting speech. The crowd received it pretty well.
Okay, well, I see the theme is Make America Safe Again. So law and order tonight, because obviously the Trump campaign slogan has been Make America Great Again. So tonight, Make America Safe Again. So you'll hear a lot about law and order. And Wes Renfro, I have tried to refrain from making any predictions because, number one, that's not my job. Number two, I've been wrong about just about everything regarding Donald Trump. But lately, I feel like he has a better shot than ever of winning in November because I think fear is a motivator. People are looking around the world. They see Baton Rouge yesterday, Dallas, some of the strife that has come in this country, terrorist attacks, Nice, France. I mean, it sort of just feels like every other day there is something. Fear is a motivating factor. Trump has been pretty authoritarian in many ways in this campaign, but maybe the world is gravitating toward authoritarian figures in these moments. Do these events help him or Hillary Clinton more right now?
It's really tough to know, given that they're both such exceptional candidates. I think that many folks will be moved by fear and by sort of some degree of isolationism. I think those folks are probably already Trump supporters to begin with. What we need to remember is that the election will be decided by a relatively small number of voters who are undecided. And so the idea that this issue will swing the election in one camp or the other, I'm somewhat skeptical of. And what we know is that in presidential elections, the biggest predictor, the most important variable, is demographics. And the Democratic nominee has won what we call the popular vote in 5 out of the past 6 presidential cycles. The only exception is 2004, and that was a relatively narrow win for George W. Bush, who was an incumbent wartime president. The problem that Donald Trump faces is that there's simply not enough white Americans, and he hasn't been able to bring in people of color into his coalition. And so that does not bode well for him in November.
Okay. Wes, when you use the term exceptional candidates, how do you define that?
They are both extremely well-known. They're both very polarizing. If you look at the polling on them, there are very few folks who have sort of middle-of-the-road positions. People either like them or they don't. People already have their minds made up. And if you put that into historical context, that's true to some degree every year, but this year it's exceptional.
Karen, you want to jump in there? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, so it comes down to, in a way, who has the better get-out-the-vote effort? I would say that the Democrats and Hillary Clinton are much better at this, but Trump has some very highly motivated voters, and sometimes they can swing an election. It's hard for me to judge because I find when you're at these conventions, now I'm at the RNC, you kind of get brainwashed for whichever candidate is the main candidate, and, you know, this is the first day of it, you hear people talking about, yeah, Trump could win this way and that way, and you know, you start to believe it yourself. Next week, I'll probably swing around in Philadelphia and think Hillary Clinton's going to win. So I won't weigh in on that, but it's going to be, you know, who votes? Who's the most motivated? I think Clinton's weakness and strengths at the same time is that we know her. So are voters nostalgic for the 1990s, which are now viewed as, you know, a relatively peaceful and prosperous time? Or is it we don't want any more of the establishment, and that's what the Clintons represent?
Well, Wes made the point, Karen, that, you know, demographics don't favor Trump. When it comes to looking at voter demographics and, you know, maybe not enough white voters. A couple of things on that. First of all, are you seeing much diversity where what you've seen so far at the convention in Cleveland, Karen?
No. It is mostly white. I mean, that's to be expected. I think with the Republican Party, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, there was a big reception there last night that the city of Cleveland put on. And, you know, because there's not a lot of corporate sponsors here, all the delegates showed up. So I was mingling with them, and very nice group of people, but, yeah, not racially diverse.
Yeah, you know, the Twitter was having some fun with Paul Ryan put a picture out of Capitol Hill interns and on the Republican side. And boy, I don't know how much diversity at all there was, almost none in the picture. And people were saying, what's missing in this picture? Of course, the Democrats respond and they put their intern photo out immediately. And you see all kinds of diversity. But on the demographic side, here's something that I don't have the numbers enough to weigh in and say, but let me just tell you anecdotally, and I'll ask Karen and Wes both about this. I'll start with you, Wes. I've talked to some voters in Yates County. I've talked to people in rural parts of this area, and they say, look, you can say that there aren't enough white voters to counteract the Democrats' demographic advantages, but there are many disaffected rural white voters who basically sit out elections regularly anyway. That they haven't really been rock-ribbed Republicans. They're more conservative in their values, but they haven't really felt like the party has been with them. It's the first time in a while they feel like the political process brings them in. So you will see more disaffected white rural voters coming out and voting, and that may make up for any sort of a gap. Again, I don't have the numbers to say that makes sense or not, but I'm hearing a lot of that sentiment. What do you think, Wes?
That's basically a myth. We heard this a lot in 2012 after Mitt Romney's defeat. Some folks call this the white voter hypothesis. Even if all of those folks turned out, right, which would be very unusual, but even if they all turned out, it's a stretch to think that they can overcome the demographic advantage that the Democrats have by assembling a much more diverse coalition. And every year that goes on, it becomes harder for Republicans to win the presidency because they have not been successful at bringing in non-white voters into the coalition. And the big opportunity that they lost was Hispanic voters.
Okay, so...
I'll defer to Wes on his theory, but I just have one question. What if Democrats stay home? Because, you know, anecdotally, a lot of Democrats that I know, they're not super enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton. They just see her, you know, as they don't want Trump to win.
So all sorts of things are possible. The question is whether or not they are likely to happen. And it's, I think, possible and maybe even likely that turnout across the board will come down for both Trump and Clinton. But this idea that huge numbers of Democrats in so much that they could swing the election to Trump's camp will sit this out strikes me as somewhat far-fetched, although it is possible. If we look at the folks who constitute the Democratic coalition, those folks actually have higher voter turnout in the past couple of electoral cycles than do the folks who support the Republican candidates. And so you would really have to see an enormous amount of those folks sit out this election, which is possible, but I think unlikely.
Okay, listeners, if you want to weigh in on if you're going to vote and how you sort of read the current state of things, we'd love to hear from you. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Last I saw Nate Silver, who has had his record somewhat besmirched by Mr. Trump and has sort of owned that a little bit, but he has been on the money in the last couple of national elections, 08 and 12. He's putting Trump's chances, the last I saw, around 28% or so. Wes, you seem to be in that category of thinking demographically. It doesn't sound like you think Trump has all that much of a chance.
You know, it's possible. I think it's unlikely. Nate Silver's model is very good. There's actually a better model out there. If you look at the secondary betting markets, they have a really great record of calling general elections. The best one, for my money, is a British site called Betfair UK. And if you've looked at the 8 or 9 month average, I think the lowest that Hillary Clinton has gotten, according to that futures market, is a 68% chance of winning, maybe 65, and sometimes she's up to 75, and that's pretty consistent.
Karen, before...
Leave it to the bookies, right?
Yeah.
I was just going to say, you can bet on anything. Karen, before we let you go, when it comes to your coverage, what's sort of the day-to-day plan for you, and what can we expect coming up?
Well, I'm focusing a lot on the breakfast, because that's when all the New York delegates gather together, and they have a number of interesting speakers coming up. Donald Trump Jr. is supposed to address the convention. It's also a good way to get people to react. I mean, NPR is going to cover, you know, the main stories, yep, the main speeches, so I don't need to do that. But I'm looking at, you know, angles related to New York. For instance, you know, Trump, he says he wants to build this big wall. It's going to be bigger than the Great Wall of China. Do all Republican delegates here support that? I'll give you a preview. I've talked to some, and they don't, and I'm going to be reporting on that a little later in the week.
All right. Well, we'll be looking for your reporting here. And, Karen, as always, it's great to get your insight and your reporting, and thank you. Thank you for being in Cleveland, and we'll talk to you as the week goes on.
You're very welcome. It's lots of fun.
Karen DeWitt, reporting from Cleveland, our Capitol Bureau correspondent. And so... one more quick question for Wes before I get back to your phone calls here. Wes, when it comes to what we won't see at the convention this week, we often see the rising stars well-positioned. Barack Obama used a keynote address at the 2004 convention to great effect, launched his career in many ways. We've seen Julian Castro, the Democrats have focused on. Chris Christie got a prime slot, I think 4 years ago, right, when a lot of Republicans thought, well, he's next up. But you don't see that on the schedule right now? The Republicans essentially not positioning a young or up-and-coming face?
Two things. You know, Donald Trump complained that the 2012 convention was boring and he vowed to make it more entertainment-oriented. I think that has come at the expense of sort of the younger crop, the rising stars in the Republican Party. None of them have primetime speaking slots, for example. I also think that Donald Trump has a problem with Republican operatives. I think that many of these folks are somewhat hesitant to be publicly associated with the campaign. When we look at, for example, GOP members in the House or in the Senate, many of them are privately and off the record saying that they're just trying to salvage their own races and hope that they can retain control of one or both chambers of Congress. And so There are very few of them slated to partake in the convention, and I don't think that there's many that really want to, and that's a problem for 2020.
Okay, let me get to the phone calls, and this is Dan in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Dan.
Good. How are you doing today?
Good.
Good. Listen, first of all, I want to say one thing. This Donald Trump is a con man. He's a joke. I can't believe nobody's going after him on his inconsistencies on both his rhetoric and
Dan, you think nobody's reported on that? I mean, like, I think...
No, I'm just saying, keep harping on it. But that's not my question.
Okay.
The question I want to ask your guest, if the shoe was on the other foot right now, let's say that the Democrats were in charge in 2008, and the Republicans took over, and we're losing 700,000 jobs a month, unemployment almost 12%, and the stock market down to 6,000, And they got in power. What they be saying about the Democrats now? That's all I want to say.
Dan, thanks for the phone call. So a couple of points there. I think Dan is saying, Wes, that if you look at the Dow has tripled under the Obama administration, but it was down at 6,000. He started from a – if you went lower, we've been in super crisis, but he started at the lowest possible point. Unemployment numbers are down, though I know a lot of folks are still sort of staying out of the workforce, but employment numbers are certainly much better than they were 8 years ago. There's a lot that Dan says if Republicans had been in charge, they would be touting that, but they're attacking that. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. And, you know, we don't actually know the extent to which the president affects the economy. Probably not all that much in the grand scheme of things.
We give him more credit and more blame, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. But the bottom line is Dan saying he thinks that a lot of the attacks are politically based and not reality based.
Of course.
And you're just saying that's history. Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, it's not really about what the record actually indicates. It's about what people believe to be true. And so we have great examples of this. Folks misremember things about the economy and about politics all the time because it helps them confirm the biases and the ideologies that they already hold. That's been true. It's a primal part of psychology. If the shoe was on the other foot, the other party would behave in the exact same way.
You're hitting my sweet spot here. Confirmation bias. But we don't teach it. I really, really want to see that being taught starting in middle school.
I teach it.
I know, but you're at the college level. It needs to start back, you know, at the much younger age, because by then a lot of people are starting to form their beliefs. Have you had students who've never really considered that before? I mean, do you have these breakthrough moments?
You know, I had a student a few years ago who, like most people, was really motivated by emotion and by sort of sacred cows that really hadn't been questioned. And there was a point during a conversation with this student that it became clear that she realized that there was just a massive inconsistency in her own thinking. It just wasn't logically tenable. I would like to think that maybe she's went out and found more information and that she's adapted and evolved. I'm not entirely sure that that's likely to have taken place.
Okay. You don't want to give yourself too much credit. I'm glad you're teaching it. And when it comes to confirmation bias, you know, Dan was saying, how come people aren't reporting on Trump's inconsistencies, et cetera? And he said that wasn't the thrust of the call, but they have. I mean, if you read Maggie Haberman and others in the New York Times, they have done a very consistently, I think, very high-quality job. It's just that, as you said earlier, I think some voters don't care, don't want to hear it, won't even read it.
And I don't even think that it's about caring. I think that, you know, if you look at evolutionary biology and psychology, we are cognitive misers. We can only keep so many balls going in the air at once. And, you know, this is what I do for my vocation, and so I pay attention. But most people have jobs and kids and summer camps, and they got to mow the lawn. And it's actually cognitively difficult to keep all of this straight, which is why we are pre-programmed to like simple answers that explain things neatly and readily, even if they're not empirically true.
I know, but, you know, a Trump voter can tell you that he opposed the Iraq War. And I could say, actually, he didn't, just factually. And here are several instances in which, at the time, he said he supported it. And they would probably say, I don't care. Just as Donald Trump last night said, well, Mike Pence supported the Iraq War. I don't care. Doesn't matter. That's what I'm talking about. I mean, it is hard. And it's not exclusive on the Republican side. I don't want to do false equivalents here, but I also don't want to pretend it's only on one side. But I just think many voters don't care. They sort of emotionally shut it off if it challenges a worldview. Yeah?
Absolutely.
What are we going to do?
You know, I really do think that it is further complicated, and there's some great evidence that really suggests strongly that it is further complicated by the fact that we are seeing a mass sorting of Americans, not only geographically, not only about the communities that we live in, but also ideologically. And so many of us only operate in echo chambers in real life, in social media, in the communities that we live in, and that makes it very difficult to find readily new information that contradicts our pre-existing beliefs.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. In Spencer Port, this is Brian. Go ahead, Brian.
I believe that Trump's choice of VP, based on his narcissism and his need for money, I couldn't possibly see him standing next to Chris Christie. Also, I think that Gingrich's ego and grifterness would have clashed. But Mike Pence, if you Google Mike Pence and the Koch brothers, you come up with the reason why he was chosen.
No, that's an interesting point. And hold on, Brian. I just want to pull this up because I have a few notes on this. Washington Post reports the following, and I'll just read from the Washington Post. Quote, Mike Pence has ties to the Koch brothers. The billionaire brothers have so far stayed out of the presidential race, a sign that they are not fans of Trump. But their 2016 involvement at the time, the Post was saying, could change with Pence by Trump's side. The resumes of several of Pence's top aides also include stints with the Koch brothers' vast corporate and political networks. But the update from the Washington Post is that Mattea Gold reporting for the Post that the Koch brothers will still not get involved in the presidential race, even with Mike Pence on the ticket. They are that dissatisfied with Trump. So,
my belief is that the Koch brothers wanted someone of theirs in the White House, and that if they couldn't get the president, that they wanted a VP, and they will back him. They've got so many different back methods of supporting things, funding things, that Pence will get the money.
Well, Brian, thank you for the phone call. So far, the Kochs are not doing that, or at least not overtly. Wes, should we be trying to follow the money?
You know, on some level, I'm a little skeptical of the idea that the Kochs are going to jump in. They've said absolutely not. And it's maybe a case of throwing away a lot of money, right?
They've thrown a lot of money away to no effect in some recent elections.
They don't seem to be getting much bang for their buck, and one has to wonder on some fundamental level if there's a point at which they size up the November election and say, absolutely not, we're not going to see any ROI.
Yeah, I mean, Adelson as well. Some big money donors have just not gotten an ROI, at least on the national races. Now, on Congress, that's where they've done very well. But I guess we'll see if Brian's right, because Brian thinks that the Koch brothers will get involved now. We don't have evidence of that. We're evidence people, but we'll see. Jane in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, some of what's been said here really upsets me. We have a lot of problems getting people to the polls, and I, for one, missed an entire state election gubernatorial for the simple reason I didn't know what the candidates stood for. They would not take a stand on anything to me on policy. So I felt like I didn't know what I was voting for. Why should I give a person my vote who won't even enunciate his values and feelings and what he's going to do? So I'm disagreeing with that people need to know policy. And if we don't know, sometimes I think we just don't vote. And really, why should we? So I think you're underestimating the voters. And it's also a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you don't get the policies out there like Bernie Sanders did, if you don't get it out there, why are we having elections to vote for these blank-faced candidates or stereotypes? It also will counter, when you have specifics on policy, these hack-eyed beliefs of the other side that people buy into. What do they have to counter it in specifics? So I disagree with that. I think policy is the number one thing, and just don't underestimate the constituencies out there. They may not vote, period, if you do. Thank you.
All right, Jane, thank you very much. Wes?
I mean, I wish that we had more high-information voters. They do exist, but they are numerically infrequent, and we can demonstrate this in myriad ways. One of my favorites is that you ask folks, how conversant are you about a domain of foreign policy or economic knowledge, political knowledge? And you might ask them about their preferred candidates' positions in terms of policy and ideology. Very few Americans, very few, actually know what they claim to know. And I wish that that was different, but most people vote based on emotions, not on logic or facts or policy.
And Jane, I will just add again, I mean, I think I take what West is saying factually. I mean, the research bears it out, but that doesn't mean that we accept that or don't care or don't present policy. And I promise we're going to continue to try to dig into that as much as we can for the numerically smaller but still number of high information voters, and hopefully growing a base of higher information voters. Not to vote in any way that a host or anybody else wants. I don't want to tell anybody how to vote. We just want better information. I'm an evidence guy. Wes, thank you. I learned a lot this hour and a lot to look for this week, though maybe not the rising stars. Very interesting point on that. We'll see if I don't know, too late to change the speaking schedule, you know, the convention. Anything can happen when Donald Trump is running the show this week, right?
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for coming in. Wes is the chair of the Department of Political Science and Legal Studies at St. John Fisher College. Our thanks to Brandon J. Smith, the State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Karen DeWitt, who's going to be reporting for WXXI News all week from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Short break and more connections next.